Hey everybody, this is Shop Talk number 257, hiring. One of the most persistently hot topic things there is in our industry, because everybody's looking for a job, changing jobs, thinking about how hiring is broken, thinking about, I don't know, all the weird hiring processes that happen and all the like yelling about whiteboarding algorithms and stuff. We're going to talk about all that. We have some unique guests that have done a lot of thinking about hiring in tech, and we're going to be peppering them with questions and having them tell us about what they think and what's important in the hiring process. There's a lot to get into here. This episode is sponsored by both Rollbar and CodePen. Rollbar is a error tracking for your web app, fantastic tool that you pretty much have to have if you're running a web app of almost any scale. And CodePen will tell you about how you can literally host a website on CodePen. Pretty cool. For now, Dave, please kick things off.
Hey there, Shopping Maniacs, you're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show. I'm Dave Rupert, and I've been listening to carnival music, and it's really messing up my internal rhythm clock. I'm Dave Rupert, with me is Chris Coyer.
Hey!
That one got weird.
You do that some kind of like syncopated, well, I don't know, it's interesting.
That's where my brain's at right now.
I don't mind it. I think it was on Twitter maybe a lot of months ago where we're like, we want to do a show on hiring. And I tell you, it was rooted in some like enviousness there's two kinds of podcasts in the world, Dave. There's ones like us who it's a mini business, right? Like we sell advertising and we try to do a good job. And, you know, like there's a tiny bit of money to be made in our podcast. And there's also podcasts that make none at all. They just do it for fun. But then there's like really good podcasts that are actually like that hire a bunch of people and producers and do journalism, and their shows are like all the way edited together with like a storyboard, and they talk to like 50 people for every episode, and it's just like a whole another level of podcasting. And mostly I was like, what if, you know, like what if someday Dave and I were to produce like one of those episodes? You know, like wouldn't that be cool to have like this front ender's life kind of quality of an episode? And I was like, maybe it'll be hiring. So we like baby stepped it, and we reached out, and we interviewed some people and found some stories and stuff, but it just kind of pitted out. So super sorry about that, everyone. If you talked to us, it was still very interesting, and hopefully you had some fun doing it, but we just never really made that show. More in line with Shop Talk Show, we're gonna invite some guests on who know a bunch about this and have and talk to them just how we do.
Mm-hmm. So, Chris, who do we have in the studio today?
We have somebody who is the most qualified person on planet Earth to talk about hiring, I've decided. Rebecca Murphy. Hey, Rebecca. Come on.
No pressure.
You've been writing and talking about like what makes a front ender. You are a front ender. And now you have this super double whammy because you are creating front end teams. You work at a company that's all about placing people. It's just like you are tailor-made.
I'm tailor-made for this show. Well, I'm glad to be here. I hope that I'm the expert you think I am.
And we were trying to get you for it when you reached out to us that says, hey, I'm talking about this stuff. And so, yeah, Dave, what do you got?
Oh, what's your situation now,
Rebecca? What's my deal? what's your deal? Why are you here?
What's your deal?
So these days I'm at this company called Indeed. It's this like really incredibly successful company for helping people find and get jobs that a lot of people haven't heard of. We've been around for something like 12 years or something like that. And see a couple hundred million unique visitors every month looking for jobs. So it's a pretty cool gig, but I've been here for about a year, a little over a year, And my job here is to figure out how to build a front-end organization. We haven't traditionally had a front-end specialization, and after 12 years, turns out we might maybe kind of need one. So I've been working on figuring
that out. So Indeed is a job searching place, but Indeed itself is a big company which has lots and lots of developers. And you're talking about building the team, at Indeed.
At Indeed, yeah. So we have a few hundred software engineers in 5 different offices around the world.
Wow.
It's a big operation that's growing a lot. But, you know, traditionally we've hired full stack software engineers and then just pointed them at the work that needed to be done. And that worked really well for a long time. But in the last couple of years, we started to see some cracks in that approach. So, like I said, that's what I'm here trying to figure out and improve.
Pretty big company. And was it your idea or their idea to be like, we should have a front end specific?
I wish that I could get in the head of the people who, I think they just cold called me like, you're a software engineer, you should work here. And that was a couple years ago. And in those conversations, we sort of arrived at, you know, you don't just want to throw me on a product team and ask me to write Java, because I won't. But there's this other thing that I do, and I think you might kind of need it. So it was really an evolution that we figured that out together.
So now you're kind of in charge of hiring and building out a front end team.
That's like a weird thing to say, but yeah, it sort of seems like it. So
I guess you'd kind of be like their boss. Do you think you're a good boss?
My good boss.
Do you think that?
Well, you just said I'm an expert, so
yeah.
I'm most definitely, I'm obviously a good boss.
Well, Rebecca,
well,
we have in the studio one of your former hires, Lon Ingram. Come on out. Boom.
Hey, Rebecca. Long time no work together. Bet you weren't expecting to hear me right now.
What a surprise on this show. Lon, how do you know Rebecca? And what are you doing now?
So right now,
you've moved on.
I work at RetailMeNot as a principal UI engineer. But a couple of years ago, I worked for Rebecca at a company called Bizarre Voice, where we worked on third-party JavaScript stuff and other engineering type stuff.
Well, this is great. So, Lon, you will be able to give us the kind of hard, honest answers to all of Rebecca's claims that she is a good boss and she knows about hiring. So this is very exciting. Yeah. Chris?
Yeah. So we have a lot. There's just a lot of ways that we can tackle this. And so if you're listening to the show and you're like, ooh, a show about hiring, maybe y'all out there are in the position of looking to be hired, or looking for your first job, looking for a new job. Maybe you're like one of those many people in our industry who has that common opinion that hiring is a little busted up in this industry. So there's a lot to cover there. And Rebecca, you've just hired a lot of people in this industry. So it can get, you know, I can't speak to it. I can think about what it's like. I have a little bit of experience, but for the most part, I'm not qualified to talk about this personally. And, you know, Dave's worked at Paravel for a million years, right? It's like we're not exactly on the hiring circuit. I've hired a handful of people and they just kind of fell into my lap. So I haven't gone through the thing like interviewed 100 people to find one. And once in a while you hear the story is like, hiring's impossible. You can't find anybody out there in the industry right now. It's the hardest problem you're going to face as a company is this hiring stuff. And then some people are like, I'm good. I can't find anything. And like, how do those stories reconcile with each other?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's been really interesting in, like I said, we didn't have a front-end specialization of any sort when I showed up. And so I think they had to put together an interview just to hire me because I wasn't going to make it through the normal CS heavy interview.
No kidding. You're that perfect right? story who would fail the whiteboarding.
And I was just really upfront with them about it. It's like, if you ask me to do that, like, let's just thanks for lunch and let's just go home. Cause this isn't really going to go anywhere. And so they really put their heads together to figure that out for interviewing me. But then as I'm trying to actually grow, you know, an organization here, I'm having to make that a repeatable process. You know, they cobbled it together, but not in a way that they could do it over and over again without, you know,
interesting.
The same people.
So you're anti the, you know, FSBAs, whatever.
I'm pretty anti FSBAs. We do have, when we bring candidates on site, I can tell you about our interviewing process right now, and it may be different in a month. Because we're very much still figuring this out, what makes sense for Indeed and what makes sense for the candidates. But we've really emphasized practical front end experience and being able to apply that experience. So we start with a take-home exercise that has no time limit. It's the kind of exercise that you can probably muddle through if you don't know what you're doing, but we'll be able to tell from the code that you muddled through it. And you also, there are a lot of opportunities for people to knock it out of the park. So we start with that. And then if you get through that, we will talk to you on the phone about it. And then if you get through that, then we bring you on site and do a couple of a couple of 1 hour interviews that are focused on real front end things that you might have to do. And then we do still have one of our kind of holdover questions from the full stack computer science-y whiteboards, but we've gone through the long list of questions that we have and picked out a few that are like, you know what? You could very reasonably find yourself in a conversation about this problem if you were to come work here. Or a problem that's a lot like this.
Right, which is, of course, that can stick around. I mean, if it's actually relevant to the actual work.
But there are a whole host of problems we have that are much more theoretical. Like, can you apply computer science to a pretty abstract problem? And those we aren't using in the front-end interviewing process because they just... I'm not convinced that for what we need right now, that the presence or absence of that skill is really super relevant.
Yeah, Lon, you have like a CS background. So what's your thoughts on that and how's that all?
So I agree with Rebecca that a CS interview, CS like traditional whiteboard, hey, figure out when to say hash map, is not the most appropriate bar or measure of a candidate's expertise. With the caveat that if they are a new graduate, in other words, if they're coming out of a computer science program at the university level, I actually do think it is, because essentially what you're doing there is you're saying, okay, how good were you at your job for the last 4 years, which was to learn how to do this sort of thing?
Right.
But even that just tells you sort of retrospectively how well they did. It doesn't tell you how well they're going to perform as a... a front-end engineer, which is an entirely different discipline, and one where I find it much more useful to ask questions that are rooted in practical experience and that get to things like, do you understand how a network works? Do you understand how performance works across a network? And essentially sort of practical distributed systems type questions, but about the web.
Yeah, and Lon and I have spent many a Sunday afternoon at our favorite bar talking about exactly this and like talking about what are we really trying to get at with these interviews, because there's a lot of people who show up and say, I can do front end, but you put them in a situation where they have to solve a moderately complex problem without all the like framework stuff that is kind of a security blanket. And it turns out that they don't actually understand fundamental concepts like closures, asynchronicity, prototypal inheritance, those sorts of things. And so I know with my interviews, I'm trying to get at, like, can you operate in the absence of frameworks? We'll use frameworks for some stuff, but one of the hardest projects going on right now that we have explicitly cannot use a framework because it would contribute too much weight to the solution. We have to write it in vanilla JavaScript. It has to be fast. It has to be unobtrusive on the page. Mm. And so those sorts of skills, being able to think in web, think in JavaScript, that's what I'm trying to get at with the
That employee would be interviews. More valuable to you. Not only more valuable, but kind of required. If you came up and you only had Angular experience, that person may excel somewhere in which that they're only using Angular, they don't plan to switch, it's comprehensive across their site and stuff. But the day they do switch, they might be like, lost.
Yeah, and I think that that person can be successful. There are jobs where your job is to be good at Angular.
Yeah.
Those exist. I think they don't tend to exist at companies. I don't know how to characterize like companies like where I work and where LawnWorks,
if from the outside, I would guess that you are one of those kind of companies, but it turns out you're not. You know, I would think it'd be a product kind of company, you know, and they just do things one way. And
yeah, but like it turns out that the problem space, yes, we have people who are building websites in React, but a React expert doesn't scale. If they can only write React. Now, if Dominic wants to come work for us, like I bet he scales. So I don't want to say React expert. Or I'm sorry, Dan, not Dominic. If Dan Abramoff wants to come work for us, I bet he scales just fine. But somebody who can only think and function in React or in Angular or whatever, I can't put them in an arbitrary front end situation and expect them to be successful.
So I guess from your hiring perspective, you can't depend on somebody who has one giant hammer that they use for everything.
Right.
Yeah.
I think both Lon and I are really looking for, do you understand this space? If you understand this space, then you'll have no trouble learning React. And if we switch to Angular in a year, you'll have no trouble learning Angular. We're looking for, do you understand this space and the constraints, and that the constraints here are different than the constraints when you're working with backend code.
What's going through your mind, Lon?
I agree with Rebecca. It's about understanding the fundamental underpinnings of the web and sort of like, you know, for lack of a better non-sports related metaphor, like the blocking and tackling, so to speak, of just like, do you understand how the network works? Do you understand the difference between HTTP 1 and 2 and why it matters, why latency dominates? My focus is often on performance. And so I've joked with Rebecca before that my career seems to have become explaining TCP slow start over and over again. and that's a whole nother topic. But essentially, if someone, you know, like the details of what makes performance hard on the web are teachable, but if the person just fundamentally doesn't understand that there's a network involved and some of the implications of that, then it's really hard to know how to move forward with them.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by Rollbar. That's rollbar.com/shoptalkshow. That's the URL you want to go to get 3 months of their bootstrap plan for free. Rollbar is all about error tracking. It does an amazing job of that. So you know, it's really easy to integrate too, and it integrates into any application, you know, JavaScript, which is Ember, Angular, Backbone, Node.js, or your Ruby stack with Rails, .NET, PHP, even Flash, iOS, anything. They've got it all covered. You put it in there and it starts capturing the errors that your app throws, which it's definitely throwing some, believe me, and lets you know about them. So not only so you need to know what these errors are in order to fix them, gives you the stack trace and all that, it groups them intelligently too. So if your app is like throwing like thousands of this one kind of error, but it's kind of minor, it's good to know. It's good to not get an email about every single time that error happens thousands of times. That's annoying. You know you need to fix it, but maybe it's lower priority than some other kind of bug, and allows you to prioritize and that type of thing. It integrates with like Slack and Jira tickets and all that type of stuff too. So you kind of get to decide like, okay, put this type of error here or whatever. It allows you to, you know, gives you the information you need to fix the errors that are happening in your app and prioritize them and know about them, and but not be too annoyed by them. Stuff like that. Just a couple of lines of code to integrate into your app, whatever that app is. Oh, it's kind of amazing software. Thank you, Rollbar. Again, the URL is rollbar.com/shoptalkshow. $87 value to sign up for their Bootstrap plan for free.
Is like front end surface area a problem? Like we have HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, and each of those things are gigantic pools of problems. Like,
yeah.
Do you know all of HTML, like all the semantics and a good document outline, accessibility? Do you know all of CSS, like the 1,000 key value pairs that make a website pretty? Do you know, like, you know, are you able to code that without Bootstrap? Or I guess that would be the similar, like, are you able to make a website without React? And then the JavaScript side of things, I mean, just huge implications over there.
I think that the surface area, I go back and forth on this really, because I look at our full stack engineers and we do expect them to be able to context switch between different technologies and different problem spaces. But I think it is a huge problem. I think it's especially a huge problem because you have people like Lon and I who have really gravitated toward the JavaScript side of things. And you know, I am capable of writing CSS, but I'd rather not. Thank you. I certainly, like, that's not how I want to spend my day. I find it hard to do it well.
So there's specializations even amongst front end.
Right. But then like a thing that is hard to figure out is how do we, if we're going to get down into like these sub specializations in an organization that has historically just valued full stack software engineers with a CS degree. Wow. There's some interesting contention there. How do I put somebody, I really value somebody who, you know, knows accessibility inside and out. Or I really value somebody who can think systematically about how we're going to have consistent performance CSS across dozens of products. But it's a specialization within a technology, not within a framework. So I'm not going to hire a Bootstrap expert, but I do want to hire a CSS expert. That's hard to say on a podcast that you don't have to bleep out.
So this sounds like we're going... We're going towards, you know, kind of a fundamental understanding is going to be better for you, right? Or whatever, that's what you're hiring for. Do you think that advice scales? Are you going to do better on Indeed.com if you have this deeper understanding of the, like, I know that's what you want, but is that what everywhere wants? Is that what everybody wants? Or, I mean, you know.
I think in an organization of a certain size, that's going to be the key to do well. And I think back to Bizarre Voice, which is smaller than Indeed, but still a decent size, couple hundred engineers. We did need people who could think in the space and apply fundamentals, not just work in frameworks. I think that at startups and in, say, an agency situation, being proficient in a framework is your ticket. So it really is kind of like, where do you want to go?
Yeah.
And starting from the framework perspective, so if you know, trying to like learn the fundamentals of the web is more like a lifelong journey than it is a destination. So I think starting from learning a framework really well, getting a job at an agency or doing product at a company that is like, we're a React shop, so if you know React, we're going to hire you. I think that is a great way to get started as an engineer, but sort of moving to the next level where you can be expected to generalize that knowledge, that's the tricky bit. And so my advice from there would be like, learn the fundamentals of your framework and then find out like, why does it work that way? You know,
exactly.
What is the reason that React has this virtual DOM diffing? And you can find like 9 million explanations of that. And kind of really dig into some aspects of that, figure out what you're excited about there, and then start generalizing your knowledge beyond just the framework itself. So you sort of start narrow and then broaden out. And I think that's a good a good strategy.
Yeah, so you can be good and productive and like be on this cool hip React bandwagon, but it doesn't mean you have to stop there, and please don't stop there.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, I think it's let's do a little framework bashing here for a second. I think that frameworks, I'm not going to bash any particular framework, but I think that
it's Ember. You can just say,
yeah, no, it is.
Frameworks make it so much more possible for you to not be curious about what's happening.
Interesting.
And I think that people who take the time to be curious about how does this actually work and why does it work and how does it do what it does, they are just at an advantage when it comes to being able to progress their career beyond, you know, I know React and so I can get a job doing React. I know Angular, I can get a job doing Angular. I think that curiosity is an important part of it. And in the absence of that, without the curiosity to learn how that works, you'll be employed for as long as React is cool. Stayed cool for a couple of years, so that could work out. But that curiosity is what will make sure that you continue to have opportunities as frameworks come and go.
We did some framework. I mean, you already mentioned Bootstrap once. And speaking of Bootstrap, there's this. This was how long ago? It was the end of last year, so it's only 3-4 months ago. There's that Jacob dude at Fat on Twitter, right? Had this thing blow up where he took the intern take-home test at Dropbox and failed. And it's like, clearly he's a pretty good developer. I don't forget all the places he's worked, but I think Twitter at least, right? And clearly.
Medium, Twitter.
Yeah.
He's responsible for a lot of the things you like.
Dude knows what he's doing, right? There's no way that he wouldn't be productive at Dropbox. Unless, there's all this other stuff about hiring, all the soft skills and the, whatever. But assuming that he's okay there, having a person like this fail the Dropbox intern interview seems a little crazy. So do you remember this or what do you think?
I remember it, but I think that this goes like, I don't know what the Dropbox intern interview is. So I can't really say anything, but I think that it's possible that that's something that is targeted at those recent college grads or soon to be college grads. And then we go back to what Lon was saying that if all you've ever done in like your grown-up life is go to school to learn CS,
maybe it makes sense to ask you about those things.
Yeah. Right. But to use that as a tool to interview Jacob Thornton, yeah, that's dumb. Don't do that.
They didn't know who he was, though. He took it kind of anonymously.
And that, I think, is actually something that gets to a subject I wanted to talk about, which is that how you get hired at a certain point is that you know people. And this is actually a problem, right? So, like, if Jacob was on the market, which he's not, then, or maybe he is, but I don't know, then I would make darn sure that the interview, he was going to be a good fit for the job, and then I would make sure that he passed the interview, right? Like, and I don't mean like I would put my thumb on the scales, but I would make sure that the same thing that Indeed did when Rebecca came aboard was, she was like, look, I'm not going to pass your normal interview, so you need to figure out a better way of understanding my value to you as a candidate. And that works great in the small, like on the, hey, I'm in some back channel IRC room and I'm like, I'm thinking about switching jobs. And then people are like, cool. Hey, I want to hire you. But it doesn't really scale and it produces these weird, I don't know, it has like societal side effects that make me uncomfortable. You see people announce that they're looking for gigs on Twitter, but way more often you see someone announce that they have a new job. And so these people, a lot of times it's hard to hire the more senior engineers because they're never actually on the market.
Yeah, I find that highly true, that they just kind of bounce around because they know where they want to go. And
yeah,
there's all this back scene stuff. Even the people who are looking for a job for the first time, I tend to, and this is totally anecdotal, but they end up meeting somebody at a meetup, or they got a friend who knows somebody who knows somebody. The from totally raw to hired is maybe there's less hires that way than there is backdoor handshaking in person.
One thing that I will, working at a company that helps people get jobs, it is fascinating how these hiring economies work in different cultures. And I can't and won't talk about it at length because I don't know all the details, but that's been one interesting thing. Like in the tech space, this is how people get hired. It's a really key way that people get hired. In India, oh my gosh, it is completely different dynamic for how people get hired. And in China, it's yet another dynamic how people get hired. And in Germany, it's yet another dynamic how people get hired. So, there are different cultural realities around this. I think it is a bummer that that's often the case. And it leads me to want to say, okay, how can we improve? How can we make sure that that is the focus of every interview, not just of the interview for the senior software engineer we definitely want to get our hands on? Like, how do we make sure that every interview is aimed at?
It worked great for you, but it doesn't, it worked great for you for reasons, right? You're this known person, or like, it's almost unfair that it worked for you. Can you skip?
Right. So how do we create an interview process that asks that question of what value will this person provide to the company? And is that value valuable enough to hire them? Mm-hmm. Rather than saying, can you traverse a something tree? I don't even know the words to say here, but...
I fail.
Yeah.
So how do we make that the focus of the interview? And that's like I was saying, why I, and I think Lon has been doing this too, is really trying to point the interview at, can you operate effectively in the front end space rather than can you operate effectively in the computer science algorithm space?
Can we try to define like operate in the front end space a bit more? You famously or infamously, Rebecca, wrote the baseline for front-end developers, which I still don't meet. But what is this operating in the front end? What
These days, well, gosh, it's okay that you don't meet that bar because that bar is like super old now. I wrote that in 2011 or something like that. These days for me, there are still some fundamentals of, do you understand asynchronicity? Do you understand closures and how they work and when to use them? For a long time, we were using this question that was this deceptively simple question. It was basically like, count 1 to 10, one number per second. Not a whole lot more to it than that. But that one simple question got really, it was a great screening question for, do you understand asynchronicity and closures in JavaScript? Mm-hmm. And so that remains kind of that is the door you have to be able to walk through in order for us to keep having.
You kind of assume that if you get that, then there's all this other stuff that is so much more basic than that, that you almost automatically get, like, what's a variable? What's a loop? What's a...
Right. And then on the flip side, there's also like, if you don't get that, like you haven't reached the level of experience. Like if you can't answer that question, you haven't reached the level of experience that I'm looking for.
That's good for everybody. You're not going to have a good time working.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah.
It's just,
yeah. But the other things that I'm looking for these days are, I mean, not these days, always. How do you organize your code? How do you eliminate, how do you make your code clean, readable, maintainable? These days, that means, like, do you understand tools such as Webpack? Have you worked with them? I don't need you to know the, like, inner details of it, but does it freak you out or not? It freaks me out sometimes, too, so I don't want to go too far. I'm also really starting to, a year ago I wouldn't have said this, but these days I'm really looking for knowledge around ES6, at least the basics, maybe not not in great detail, but if you haven't dabbled in ES6 by now, then you're probably not what I'm looking for. It doesn't mean that you're a bad developer, it's just you're probably not what I'm looking for. I don't go ahead. Yeah, Lon, you may have some other sort of like table stakes things.
So that last one is actually, I think, a good example of one thing I'm looking for, which is that the individual is has some level of sort of curiosity. And I'm not looking for that from the reason I'm, this is a front-end specific thing, which is that because the front-end, the specifics of the front-end change so much and there are so many moving pieces, well, you know, as browsers ship new updates and we have these evergreen browsers, it's basically like part of one's job as a front-end engineer is to stay up with those developments. And if the person doesn't seem interested in doing that, then it makes me worried that they may not do well, that they'll sort of stagnate and not be able to stay with the web as it moves forward. Although I do want to draw a bright line and say that that doesn't mean that I expect somebody to be like coding in their free time if they don't want to. Like, I don't really like that aspect of, you know, where people are like, oh, if you don't have a GitHub, then I don't want to hire you, because, you know, people have lives and that may not necessarily allow for that, or maybe they just don't want to do that, but they're very good at their jobs. So, but if they don't have that curiosity, then that is always sort of a negative signal for me. The other thing that I really look for is an understanding of sort of, and I talked about this earlier, but again, that what you're doing when you're building a web application or a website is you're fundamentally building a distributed application, because you're going to run part of your code on somebody else's computer that you don't control. And if you don't quite get the implications of that, then it can be difficult to build things that are more complicated. It's less so the case for like building content sites, but if you're building an app or you're going to add, you know, like if you're going to build an analytics system, for example, you really need to understand some sort of fundamental concepts about the uncertainty of running your code on somebody else's computer.
I also want to come back to what Lon was saying about performance earlier. That is, I do believe it's teachable. Learning about front-end performance and the inputs to front-end performance is teachable. But it's a great positive signal for me when somebody is articulate about front-end performance. And it's a really negative signal to me when somebody says, well, I wanted to make sure it was fast. And so I opened up Chrome DevTools and said, what metrics were you looking at? If you engage in a conversation about performance, I want it to be a real conversation about performance, not just, I looked at some graphs and they looked good.
Here.
So, but it's a really positive, I would say a differentiator, someone who can come in and talk intelligently and informedly about web performance and what the inputs are to it and why HTTP2 is going to be faster than HTTP1 and those sorts of things.
Is it?
It is. I don't know. I'm on if I come back to Twitter later today, I probably have to yell at some people, or people are yelling at me about HTTP2 right now. But yeah, so that's not a, like, I'm okay if you don't know that, but if you do know that, that is a great place to invest time in learning. I highly recommend high performance browser networking.
Yeah.
At even just the first chapter. You can read the rest, that's fine. But just the first chapter, if you read that and really understand it, you will stand out from the candidates that I'm tending to see.
There you go, everybody. Hot tip.
Boom. Yeah. And Ilya can send me my royalty checks
later. Well, I'm gonna squash that plan by pointing out that it's free and online. And actually, that brings me to, there's another free online book, which is Google's Site Reliability Engineering book. And that
just rolls off the tongue.
Yeah, it's really easy to say. Also, the SRE book is what you'll often hear people refer to it as, and that's now free online. I'm working my way slowly through it. And it's not really specific to front end, but, you know, there's a second part of that phrase, which is engineer. And so another thing that I really look for in candidates is, like, do they understand engineering? Do they understand how to build systems that are testable, that are monitorable, that are robust, that will usually not fail, and if they do fail, fail in ways that can be understood? And do they know how to, like, sort of productionize those systems? And so that whole, like, aspect of things, when you're narrowly focused on the front end, and particularly, like, content-type sites, it's a little harder to get that experience. And so adding that to your repertoire can really broaden your opportunities, in my opinion, because you know, we're building like real apps on the web now, big complicated things, and doing that well requires that we follow sort of best practices. And so having an understanding of those best practices is key.
We mentioned that there's specializations and stuff. This, so far we've talked, and I think both of you are fairly JavaScript-y in your mm-hmm. stuff, but is there a story for the people who listen to this show who's like, you know what, I have this surface level understanding of JavaScript, but you know what I rock at is CSS architecture and accessibility, and I do have an eye for performance, and performance at its root comes down to some of that basic HTML and CSS stuff. Are those people still valuable, or is that story dwindling?
I think this is another thing that Lon and I spend lots of quality time talking about. So I'm sure I'll have things to say here too. I think that they are still valuable, but in the absence of skills to at least write tooling, and tooling needs a programming language that is not HTML and CSS. It doesn't have to be JavaScript. You can write it in Bash if you want. Probably not, but JavaScript is certainly where the tooling ecosystem is. So in the absence of the ability to write tooling that validates that your work is correct, that automates processes, that makes your code easy to consume, that makes your documentation easy to generate, those sorts of things, I think that the market for people who don't have that tooling, that ability to create basic tooling around the HTML and CSS solutions they're creating, that market is limited. Mm-hmm. People who really just want to write HTML and CSS and do not want to learn how to write code, it's a hard spot.
Yeah, maybe Lon, take that for a second, and then we'll expand the idea.
Yeah, so that I agree is tricky. What I will say is that another thing that's really tricky is writing CSS in a way that doesn't result in just what do they call it, like an append only file, like you always, your CSS never shrinks, it always grows. And you know, if you want to implement things like the inline CSS pattern to improve the performance of your site when it first loads, you're really going to need to rest on, you're going to have a hard time doing that if your CSS is like 200K. you really need that to be small, and the way that you have CSS that's small is you have people who understand how to write CSS efficiently. But I do agree with Rebecca that starting from there, that's good, but if you don't know how to turn that into tooling, or at least how to leverage tooling to allow other engineers to sort of use your expertise, then it becomes a lot harder to sell yourself. And you really need to understand how to talk about that story as well. It can't just be like, well, you know, let's do these different things in SAS because that's the right way to do it. You have to be able to communicate why it's the right way to do it, and specifically in terms of like file sizes and you know, reflows and that sort of language that you can really tie to performance and efficiency of a team that's building software.
Hey, this episode of Shop Talk is brought to you in part by CodePen. Did you know you can literally host a complete website on CodePen with your own custom domain name? You can. It's pretty cool. It's part of CodePen Projects and a pro feature of CodePen Projects. So you like, you know, CodePen Projects is your own file system in the sky, right? You can host all your assets in there, multiple HTML files, process your SAS, all that's kind of, you know, more like a desktop IDE, although it's writing CodePen, a new thing that we have. So then in the bottom right corner, there's a little button that says deploy, and you can open that up and look, you can hit the deploy button and it'll deploy out to a URL, a CodePen URL. It'll be like a longslug.codepen.website. That's your deployed website, meaning you can work on your project and save stuff, and that's kind of like development mode, and your deployed version stays the same until you deploy again. So there's kind of this dev and prod thing going on CodePen. But then, you know, you can point your own custom domain name at that production version of the website. You just, you know, kind of like everywhere else, you go buy a domain name or use one that you already have and point the A records as part of the DNS configuration at some IP addresses we give you, and then you're hosting your own custom website right at CodePen. One of the cool things you can do with CodePen Pro. One of the things I have opened, so you mentioned about hiring, you know, it's different, culturally different sometimes, you know, if somebody's hired in Germany might be different than it's hired here. It also, even here, and here I mean the United States in which all four of us live, so our experience is limited to that. It changes in time, I think. Look, I've noticed a change, and both of these things are not sponsoring this show, but ever have, I think. One of them is something like hired.com, which is kind of like and Indeed has a version of it. So I see this as a bit of a trend called Indeed Prime, right? Which is I'm good or whatever. I'm a person who wants to be hired. And the way I'm going to choose to approach that is to use one of these two tools in which that I just tell the world about myself and then just sit back and wait for things to happen kind of thing. Companies apply to you is right. A way, which is right. Maybe that's, and then can I attach that to another story? And I don't, maybe this is fair. And if it's not fair, just strike me down. There's a force of nature happening, which is all these coding boot camps. I look at how many there are and how many students they attract and how much money they're making. And it's really weird and interesting and new thing that's happening only in the last, I'd say, 5 years in our industry. They've just exploded and they're just pumping out kids. And they all say, here's huge promises. They all say there's a massive labor gap that's going to happen and the gap's getting even wider. We got to fill these gaps with people. So is there a ton more people piling into our industry? And is that, and they come out with this some set of knowledge and some set of like, I was promised $100,000. So I'm going to use Indeed Prime because I just want Dropbox to apply to me.
I think the great thing about products like Prime or like Hired is that it does take that kind of who do you know part out of it. It also takes out the, you know, how do I let people know that I'm looking? I've run into that. Sometimes I wish I could, you know, post a tweet saying I'm looking for a job, and then I'll get fired. So
I prefer without your coworkers, right? And no.
And so I think those sorts of products are really interesting for that, and I think they're a great way. It makes the process more objective. And I know with Indeed Prime, we have people who actually help job seekers tailor their resume to the companies that are interested in them and help them improve their resume and that sort of thing. So it like makes it a more objective process and positions an unknown quantity a lot better than, you know, just applying to it.
It's just a change. It's just like this is a new, interesting way to find a
job. Yeah,
it's not necessarily, you know, millennials are cocky.
No, I think it's just, and I think it works well for markets where there's high demand. There's a lot of supply, but the quality of the supply is all over the map. So it solves problems for the job seeker who says, I'm good, but I don't know how to get in front of the company, how to prove it to a company. And it solves for the employer who says, I only need people who are good. I don't have time to go through 1,000 resumes to find those.
And they're willing to pay for it.
And they're willing to pay for it. So I think it solves both sides of that, but only solves it in an economy where there is high demand, high but unknown quality supply. We're not going to see probably like a product like that for, wait staff at a restaurant because there is high demand, there is probably high supply, the quality is more standard, maybe, let's say. With code schools, I think that's a
do you hire out of them, or just is it a blanket no, or is it more
one of my best team members is out of the ADA initiative. We absolutely hire out of them, and I've had great experience with people who we hired out of them, but they had to get through our interview process. And a lot of the people coming out of code schools just don't have those fundamentals that we were talking about. And the people that I can think of who've impressed me out of code schools, unfortunately, like they already had some they had already level done some field. Work. Yeah,
you're
they
good,
had
you're
already,
good.
Yeah. So I've seen people come out of code school, so it's just like, you're going to have to go do work that pays you half of what you were promised, and in 5 years, maybe you'll be there.
Yeah, I've had a similar experience with the code schools. They're sort of uneven in quality, so there's some really, really good ones out there, and there's some others that are maybe not so good. You know, one thing that you do get out of code school candidates is often they are changing careers, and so they're older and have a lot of experience and soft skills and life lessons that a new college grad is not going to bring to the table necessarily. So there's an advantage there. And I absolutely hire out of code schools when I can. I do agree though that there's been a huge boom in this industry, and I'm not sure that the demand for junior engineers is quite up to the supply that these code schools are pushing out. In my experience anyway, it's a lot harder to find sort of mid-level to senior-level engineers. That's where the gap is for the sorts of roles that I'm looking for, as compared to more junior, like, okay, I know how to build a thing with React and Node.js because that's what I spent 6 months learning how to do, but if you want me to do it with, Backbone, then I'm going to have to go back to the drawing board.
And I know you probably want to move on, but I want to say, I know often we get kind of pushback about like, well, how do you expect people to become mid-level engineers if you don't hire junior engineers and mentor them? And I get it, but I have to have people in place to mentor those junior engineers. If I don't have people in place to help them grow, they're not going to grow. It would be unfair to them and to everybody if I just hired 10 junior engineers and said, I'm going to be your one and only mentor, but I'm too busy to actually do that. So we've got to get that mentor. That's why we need these mid and seniors to be able to have the capacity to mentor.
That's a good segue into the thing that I know we all have opinions about and thoughts about, which is that concept of a senior developer. So can I just say the word senior developer and then just pass you the baton?
Lon, go.
Golly. So there's a lot of things that go into being a senior developer or engineer. What they all have in common, in my experience, is two things: experience and judgment, demonstrated over a track, like a time period, a track record, essentially. So, like
experience and judgment.
Yeah. So.
Oh, like you just like flame people on Twitter? Is that my? Because I cast judgment all day long. I am super good at that.
Plus, I have like a GitHub repo with like 70 stars on it, so I have both of those things going.
Okay, well, are you looking? So experience meaning that you've seen lots of different things and you have like pattern recognition that you can apply to problems and say like, I was talking to one of the really senior engineers at my work and he said something along the lines of like, I was talking about a problem. He's like, oh yeah, that's like Windows Forms. And I was like, okay, and tell me more. And so basically he drew a line from this problem that I was having on a front-end web app to native Win32 development like 20 years ago. And he was able to sort of talk about how here are the common principles, here are some lessons that we learned in this area and how you might be able to apply them to your world. And so that's where that experience part comes in. And then on the judgment side, no, I don't mean judging in the sense of, separating the good from the bad, but making decisions that are in an uncertain environment that are reasonable and are cautious without being overcautious. In other words, as a senior engineer, I guess the real thing that you have to be able to deal with as a senior engineer is uncertainty and risk. And people who make good decisions in those environments that still move the company forward at a pace that isn't a snail's crawl is some of the things that I look for.
And I think of senior in terms of the scope and the scope of your influence, the scope of your influence, the scope of your impact. And so when people are trying to saying, I want to be a senior engineer, I say, start looking for opportunities to work with other teams. Start looking for opportunities to solve problems that impact more than just your very own product. And start working on collaborations with people. So just start trying to expand your engineering world. You'll be exposed to more problems, but you'll also start to show that you can solve problems that are bigger than just a ticket. Working on this one feature in your one product. So I think that's kind of how we know that somebody is ready to level up, is by a track record of having impact beyond their, beyond their job, in the strictest sense.
Beyond their job. That's interesting. I think there was a panel. I think we aired this panel on Chop Talk Show, but it was with me and you and a few other people. It was a long time ago. Remember that? It was like a list apart, something, something.
Oh yeah, that happened.
Yeah, and this subject came up again, and I don't mind. I'll talk about this every month. I think it's fascinating for constantly. But I didn't come up with it. It was you or somebody smarter than me on this panel that used the word force multiplier mm-hmm. when they talked about senior developers. That it has stuck with me, and that it means that you're good, fine, but you're 1x, right? Because you're just one mm-hmm. person. Can you? 1.5x everybody else around you just by being around,
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. That's something that I've actually been learning a lot about at work these days is I've increased my overall productivity by letting go of actually producing that work myself and spending a lot more time being a force multiplier, roadblock clearer and for the folks so that other folks can do work and I can achieve broader impacts, but I'm doing less, writing less code as a result. And you got to be careful there. You don't want to get too far. You end up basically being like a manager, God forbid. Right,
dirty,
Rebecca?
Dirty word, yeah.
Hey, it's okay. It's okay. A lot of my friends are managers.
I would say on the subject of becoming a senior engineer, I want to emphasize that one thing I've seen is a sort of like this desire to like become a senior engineer sort of earlier than is really reasonable or possible. So if you're, if you're listening and you're a junior engineer and you're trying to say like, how do I get to be a senior engineer in 3 years? Well, the answer is you might be able to find that title, but you're not actually a senior engineer. But that's okay. It doesn't really matter. What I would say, my biggest advice would be to try and find a mentor who can help you to move up and help you with that experience and who can suggest things for you to go do. So that who can say things like, hey, you should check out this, go read the SRE book, for example, which maybe you wouldn't have thought of on your own or stumbled upon. And so finding a mentor is, I think, really, really key. Yeah.
That's sort of segues into something. I know we got to wrap this up. We're hitting past our hard stop here, but how would y'all rank Chris and I?
Yeah.
Junior, medium, what's the middle, or senior developer? And I'll just roll some of my credentials. Very popular tiny jQuery plugins on GitHub. I host a weekly award-winning podcast. Whenever people start talking about spreading React props, I just laugh nervously and awkwardly because I don't want to be in that conversation. So what would you, how would you rank? And I also consult for some Fortune, 500E, 100E companies. So yeah, what would y'all say?
I need to get you in for a whiteboard to traverse the tree first.
Oh, I traverse trees. I have like 4 trees in my backyard right now. At least 4.
I haven't really worked with Chris, and so I can't really answer there. But Dave, I can answer for you, which is that I would say you're mid to senior level developer and more mid-level engineer in that you've you've demonstrated a lot of knowledge in the area of performance and accessibility, and but what I haven't seen, and this doesn't mean that you haven't done it, so you would need to like figure out how to demonstrate to me. You have 24 hours. More advanced sort of broad systems building, and that's the more engineering side of things. Does that make sense? I don't know if this is fair or not, but you asked me a really unfair question. So
no, it's fair. No, so I would have to demonstrate kind of a large scale system, or kind of have a proven dedication. Okay.
But like if you announced on Twitter tomorrow that you were going to go, that you were going to work as a principal engineer for, you know, some mid to large size company, I would think, okay, yeah, that makes sense. So yeah, that's what I would say.
It actually seems really fair. I know we joke around a lot, but I'd put myself in a similar category of and even below Dave. Like, it's not like, oh, being humble is fun and cool. Like, for real, I'm not. I might be a senior level developer, and that I do think I can be a force multiplier of people, but I try to do that like at scale. But I'm not. I'm like, no joke, the worst developer at CodePen. You know, like, I'm not. My skill is different. I do different things for the world. I'm not like a really good. Yeah.
Something I want to say about you in particular that is also a personal pet peeve right this very moment, your ability to communicate effectively and clearly and about important topics to people of all levels of technical knowledge, that's a big deal. And that's another thing, like if people listening want to progress, get better at that. Because that's another way that you'll just completely stand out from the rest, being able to effectively communicate.
It's flattering, and I'll take that. Like, thank you. But you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't make me an excellent engineer, you know?
Well, it doesn't, but...
So there's different roles that people fit, and I can give a concrete example of this. I recently ran a brainstorming session with some of our senior engineers here, and I spent a lot of time in that brainstorming session saying things like, I don't know how that works. Please explain it to me. Does this thing do that? No? Okay. I guess I said something silly because you're laughing now. And the point that I'm trying to make is that was my skill that I brought to the table, was moving that brainstorming session forward. And then there are other senior engineers in the room where what they brought to the table was they knew the system cold, top to bottom, every single detail. And you could just, as you moved in, it's like that fractal thing where like, okay, let's focus on this part, and now there's a whole new universe of detail that they can just recall and talk about cogently, but they wouldn't necessarily be as good at sort of guiding a creative discussion. And so there's room for different ways to be a more senior engineer. You can be sort of more on the communication side, on the collaborative side. You can also be... sort of really focused on like, I know the details of how Node.js internals work, like cold, because I wrote some of them and I'm like part of the technical whatever group that thing is called. And that's another way to be that, to be a senior engineer. So there's some different paths that are available, I would say.
Well, cool. We should probably wrap this up. Thank you all so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate it. We'll start with Rebecca. Rebecca, for people who aren't following you and giving you money, how can they do that?
I don't need your money, but you can follow me on Twitter at @rmurphy, but I mostly just say angry political things these days. Every now and then I say angry things by HP2 instead.
Okay. On brand. All right. Lon, how can people follow you and give you
I don't need your money either. But you can find me on Twitter. Handle is Lawnsea, LAWNSEA. You will likely know me as the dad in the chicken suit, which is how I had to embarrassingly introduce myself to several people when I was in New York City. I mostly tweet bad puns and fake band names, but occasionally I also tweet about tech. And you can find me on GitHub under the same the same handle.
Well, thank you all so much for coming on the show. And thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher of choice. Be sure to star, heart, favorite it up. That's how people find out about the show. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month, and tweet about the show. That's how people can find out as well. And if you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one. Because people are hiring people like you, whether you're junior, senior, or mid-level developer. And Chris, do you have anything else?
ShopTalkShow.com.